This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. Commuting for the 4,000 residents of Hatteras Island has been a headache as the use of the Bonner Bridge, the only highway connection to the mainland for locals, was shut down on Monday due to safety concerns. Melissa Herman has lived on Hatteras Island for 30 years. She works at Blue Pelican Gallery and says since the bridge closed, business has been very slow.
It's dead. Like, there's not a soul here. The highway's empty. I've had one person come in the shop today, and it was a local person.
Before the Herbert C. Bonner Bridge was constructed in 1963, the only way to access Hatteras Island was by plane or boat. The span, named after a North Carolina Democratic congressman, was supposed to last only 30 years because of the harsh coastal environment where it was built. But the 2.7-mile bridge has survived a half a century. Because of its age and heavy use, the bridge has fallen into disrepair. According to the North Carolina Department of Transportation, a recent bridge inspection gave the Bonner Bridge a sufficiency rating of 4 out of 100. On Monday, after last week's bridge inspections, DOT officials decided to close the 50-year-old Bonner Bridge. North Carolina Department of Transportation Division 1 engineer Jerry Jennings says routine radar scans show that high currents have eroded sand around Bent 166, one of the southern support piers for the bridge.
Over the last several weeks, we had been watching this area, and it moved, the scour moved much more rapidly than what we have seen in other places on this bridge, and it reached the point that we felt it needed to be closed because it was unsafe.
On Wednesday, a $1.6 million contract was awarded to Carolina Bridge Company of Orangeburg, South Carolina, for the emergency repairs. 10 to 12 feet of protective material will be placed around the piling to reinforce the area.
Repairs will consist of the use of something called concrete Ajax. They're similar to the types of jacks you played with as a kid, but these are about 4 feet tall and they're concrete. They are interlocked together and then they are placed around the perimeter of the area that is scoured. Then inside that, we will place large sandbags throughout the area and around the pilings that are in question. Then we'll go back with two more layers of the Ajax and the sandbags concurrently.
Jennings says a dredging company currently working to clear the Oregon Inlet has agreed to pump sand from their dredging location to where the scouring problem is located. Dredging will start Friday and take about 2 days, weather permitting. North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory has declared a state of emergency at the Bonner Bridge, which will speed repairs because the state won't have to get permits that it normally would. According to the Associated Press, the designation also allows the state to seek federal funding assistance. While the bridge is closed, the North Carolina Ferry Division is providing an emergency route open to all motorists between Stumpy Point and Rodanthe free of tolls. The routes were activated Tuesday, but went into full operation on Wednesday. Communications officer for the Ferry Division, Tim Haas.
We had an initial crush on Tuesday night, obviously, when people first found out the bridge was closed. But since then, it's kind of leveled off, and usually if people arrive, you know, on time, if they don't get on the very next ferry, they'll get on the one after that. So it's heavy traffic, but it's manageable.
Each day, the emergency ferry route is running full loads of about 760 cars per day. Haas says they've had to add runs to keep up with the demand.
We are always monitoring traffic flow. We have the capacity, if needed, to add runs. But right now, we seem to have the right amount of runs to keep running full ferries and to get everyone where they need to go.
Governor McCrory held a news conference Friday morning to talk about the state of emergency he ordered and get a closer look at the span. The emergency repairs to the Herbert C. Bonner Bridge are only a quick fix. In 2011, a $215 million contract was awarded to build a new span parallel to the aging Bonner Bridge. But before construction can begin, a lawsuit filed in July 2011 by the Southern Environmental Law Center must be resolved. DOT Secretary Tony Tata says efforts to block construction of the replacement bridge are to blame for the current problems. For Public Radio East, I'm Jared Brumbaugh. This weekend, East Carolina University's School of Art and Design will continue their holiday exhibit and sale. Unique gift items will be available, including jewelry, textiles, metal sculpture, paintings, and ceramics. Not only can you get some holiday shopping done, but you can help support the arts guilds and students of the School of Art and Design. Mac McKee speaks with interim director of the Wellington B. Gray Gallery, Tom Braswell.
thank you for joining us on the Down East Journal today.
It's my pleasure.
You've been involved in these for a good number of years, 5 to 6 years. Are these exhibition and sales extremely popular in the community, and do they help raise a lot of money for the gallery?
Yes, they've been very popular. We get a pretty good turnout every year, and the proceeds go to benefit the student art guilds here, which account for monies for conferences, for bringing in speakers, and all sorts of activities.
Now, what are some of the most popular items for sale, or even just to gaze at, that you've noticed through your years as interim director of the gallery?
I would say that ceramics and jewelry and textiles, probably because of the not only the beauty of them, but the gift-giving ability, wearability, etc. The work on display and for sale, everything's for sale, includes the work from all the different studios in the building. It's quite a range of artwork.
Now, with such a range of items, are there a range of prices from, I'll say, from the extravagant to the very affordable?
Yes. In fact, you can often find small pieces of two-dimensional art for as little as $5 or $10. And then, of course, it goes right on up, so that a piece of jewelry made out of precious metals or a piece of sizable sculpture could run in the range of several hundred dollars. So there's a very wide range of affordability.
What's one of the more unusual items that you've seen at these sales and exhibitions?
Well, I guess when it comes to unusual items, some of the sculptures in the past there have been some quite large sculptures that were very abstract and interesting and very unusual. There have also been some really interesting paintings as well. They would probably be the more unusual items.
Now, is this an annual event, Tom?
It is an annual event. It takes place almost the same time every year. It's the first weekend after Thanksgiving.
Now, has it grown in popularity in the ensuing 6 years since you've been there?
Yes, it has. We've had really good turnout, even though when you think about the timetable, about the time I arrived here was the beginning of what we refer to as the Great Recession. So I think that first year or two, sales were down, but they've really come back.
Now, as far as we're speaking today, the sale began on Thursday, but it lasts through Saturday. So really now is the best time to get in while some of the more popular items before they get snatched up, I would imagine.
That's true, yes. Saturday, we're open from 9 a.m. until 2 p.m.
All right, Tom, it sounds like there's going to be some happy people who are interested in the arts for Christmas.
I hope so.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you. It was my pleasure.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with Wild Birds Unlimited, enhancing the understanding and appreciation of nature and preserving our environment and natural wildlife habitats. Wild Birds Unlimited, serving Eastern North Carolina since 2001 at 2029 South Glen Burnie Road, New Bern.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. This has been a good year for pecans in eastern North Carolina. I've seen many trees covered in a big full crop and beautiful pecans starting to fall to the ground. I did grow up in Virginia, so why do I say pecans instead of pecans? Well, my mother was from Connecticut, and that was one word that she insisted we say the Connecticut way. So if you're lucky enough to have a pecan tree in your yard, or a neighbor one, or one that you can get to without too much trouble, and you go to pick up those wonderful nuts for your fall cooking, you may find nuts that are not in perfect condition. So what causes all these problems that we find in some of the pecans we pick up in the yard? The one that we find most often is a beautiful pecan that when we break it open, the nut inside is all dried out and shriveled and doesn't fill the shell. Well, this problem can be caused by a number of things. You see, trees can only produce a strong, heavy nut if they've had a steady supply of water and nutrients and plenty of healthy leaves to capture lots of sunlight. So these small, shriveled nuts can be caused by lack of any of those things. Here in eastern North Carolina, it's often drought. If we don't get enough rain in August and September when the pecans are filling out, they just won't mature properly. Low nutrient levels can also cause poorly filled nuts. This happens a lot here on the coast because our soils are sandy and don't hold nutrients well. If you're wondering whether your soil has adequate nutrients, go to your local extension office and pick up a soil test box and the instructions on how to take a proper soil test. This will tell you about everything except your nitrogen level. And just assume that most mature trees producing fruit can use a little nitrogen each year. Adding organic matter to a sandy soil can also help that soil maintain nutrients. What about years when things are extra wet? Can that cause problems for pecans? Well, of course it can. Scab disease becomes a problem then. It infects the pecan husk, which is that thick layer that covers the nut. It causes them to turn black and fail to open. So when you find hard, black pecans still in the husk laying on the ground, think scab disease. Pecan troubles aren't limited to diseases and moisture and fertility, though. There's also insect problems. Often you'll find a pecan with a tiny, perfect hole drilled in the side of the shell. If you find this, recognize the pecan weevil has probably been to visit. Related to that hole is the plump, cream-colored grub still inside feeding on the pecan in some instances. Another problem caused by insects? Dark bitter spots on the pecan kernel itself. These are caused by stink bug feeding. And finally, what if your tree seems to never produce more than one or two nuts? Well, recognize that pecan trees are wind pollinated and require more than one variety for pollination to occur. If you know what variety your pecan is, you can choose one that goes well with it for pollination. Hope you're lucky enough to have a pecan tree nearby that produced a beautiful crop this year. If not, find a local pecan sheller if you can and buy some fresh, sweet nuts. They taste really different when you get them fresh. And if you're going to keep them for a while, I'd roast them first and then bag them, double bag them, and store them in the freezer till they're needed. Go out pecan hunting this beautiful fall day. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
For the next 3 weeks, we'll focus on a holiday dessert and tell you how to make it as part of our series, Sweet Treats. Today, we learn how to prepare a traditional Southern holiday favorite, Pull Mints. These candies are labor-intensive, but if you ask Linda Boyer, she'll tell you they're worth it. Linda is the environmental educator at the North Carolina Estuarium. This week, she gave a demonstration on how to make pull mints, and now she's going to share her recipe with us.
I've lived in Washington most of my life, and candied pull mints have always been around. It's a really special winter treat.
To be completely honest with you, I've never actually heard of a pull mint before until I contacted you today. What is a pull mint, and how do you make them?
Well, you take sugar and water and butter, and you cook it to 266 degrees. So then you have a bubbling mixture of very sweet candy. Then you pour it onto a slab of cold marble so that it cools really quickly, and you pick it up as soon as you can stand to touch it. It's still very hot, and you start pulling it between your two hands.
It's a similar consistency as like a taffy?
Yeah, uh-huh. Well, you pull it out in long strands until you can't pull it anymore. It starts getting hard. And then you lay the strands on a table and start cutting small pieces out with scissors.
You got your scissors. What kind of a size piece of candy are you looking for?
About the size of a nickel.
Now, you use a slab of marble that you pour the hot liquid on to cool down. But if you don't have a slab of marble, will a granite countertop work just as well?
You know, I would hesitate to do that because I would hate to crack my whole countertop I don't know if that would take it or not. I've just got a portable slab of marble that's about 2 feet by 1 foot that I use.
Gotcha. Well, they don't call these pull mints for nothing. How do you give them that peppermint flavor?
After you spread it out on the marble, you add 10 drops of peppermint for every cup of sugar. So my recipe, you'd use about 20 drops.
And where would you get something like a mint extract?
You can get it at pharmacies or a lot of the specialty grocery store sections have it.
I know you've been making it for a long time, but for someone who's never made it before, how hard is it to make?
You need to pay attention to what you're doing. You need to be careful not to overcook it, and you really need someone there to help you when it's time to cut, because the mints get really hard really fast, and so you need several pair of scissors there snipping away. So it's a lot of fun. It is kind of difficult, and it takes some concentration, but it's great fun, and it's wonderful to eat the results.
Speaking of eating the results, kind of explain to me the taste and the consistency of a pull mint.
Well, after you cut it, it's very hard. So you put it in a cookie tin between layers of wax paper and seal that for 24 hours. And then when you open the lid, they've all magically turned very soft and creamy.
So they kind of melt in your mouth as you...
They do, absolutely. And they're habit forming, too.
Gotcha. And approximately how much does a batch of these pulled mints yield?
I would think maybe 200 mints.
That's a pretty good amount.
Yeah.
I'm sure during the course of the holidays, you're going to have to go through a couple of different batches, huh?
Yes, you would.
Well, Linda, thanks so much for your time and for telling us how to make our own pull mints.
Thank you, and I'll send you a recipe.
All right, great. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, too.
You can get Linda's pull mint recipe at our website, publicradioeast.org. And as our Sweet Treat series continues next week, we'll tell you how to prepare another traditional holiday recipe, the Yule Log. Christmas performances are now underway in force throughout eastern North Carolina. Among them are a series of Celtic Christmas shows featuring one of the state's links to the Celtic music world, Swansboro native and ECU grad Jennifer Lico. George Olson spoke with her about her most recent Celtic CD and has this, which originally aired in April 2008.
In trying to assess Jennifer Lico's place in the Celtic music world, I posed the following question to her.
I was thinking of the following. Are you a Celtic artist for those who know they like Celtic music but don't know why?
Oh, I like that. I like that.
Which, in its own way, might explain the approach she took to her third Celtic music release, A Thousand Curses Upon Love.
I wanted this album to be a collection of songs that weren't specifically all from Celtic nations, but that were influenced by Celtic tradition. And in that same respect, I didn't want them to be traditionally recorded with, you know, the same way everybody records traditional music. I really wanted that element of, let's make this song my own. I don't want to sound like a robot. I think it was Martin Hayes that said, there are as many ways to play Irish music as there are people playing Irish music. And I think that's so true.
The title track of the disc, sung in Gaelic, not the English translation that graces the cover, might be the prime example of Martin Hayes' comment, a traditional song, a non-traditional approach.
I wanted a really strong definition of beat. In that sense, the strong definition of the beat, because it's traditional for a walking song to have that constant beat there, because they would be walking the cloth, and that's a beating action into the table, and that's how they kept the walking going, was by singing the song and keeping this steady beat. So I wanted that to be dominant for the traditional reason, but I wanted to break all the other rules of traditional music.
The recording studio offers a unique opportunity for a musician whose live performances typically involve just voice and guitar. For one, the opportunity to bring in other performers to flesh out what on stage may be bare bones arrangements.
And while on stage, she always accompanies herself. In studio, she gets to accompany herself vocally, time and time again.
On one of the songs, I think there's something like 24 tracks of just background vocals. And when you put them all together and put them way down in the mix, you can't tell that that there's 24 tracks. The nice thing about it is that I blend with myself easily, and I know the way my voice moves, and so I can move again the same way. And it's fun. I love singing harmony, and I never get the chance to sing harmony because I'm a solo artist. And so I'm always singing the melody line, and it gets frustrating every now and then. So it was really fun to record the harmony parts.
For all the talk of fun in the studio and producing a CD influenced by Celtic traditional, but not Celtic traditional, there is at least one obvious point on A Thousand Curses Upon Love, where Jennifer tries to add to the tradition in a tune co-written by herself and the CD's producer Bob Noble. Living in Ireland for a period earlier this decade, she was hanging out after a performance when stories were told about how women's Christmas should be a month-long celebration rather than a single day, which brought the obvious question from the lone American in the group, what is women's Christmas?
And they told me that it happened on the day of Epiphany, January 6th, and that on that day, the women get to sit around and drink and eat and tell stories and sing songs with other women while the men did all the cooking and cleaning and all the chores for the day. And it was the women's time to relax and enjoy because they had done all the work leading up to Christmas. And I kind of thought it was a neat idea, and then that was it.
A Thousand Curses Upon Love also contains a track whose subject matter seems to work its way into all Celtic disc, how a man's love for the sea tears him away from loved ones left behind. That exact situation is perhaps not endured too often in modern times, but in performing the song, Jennifer found her own corollary in her own personal life with her recent engagement.
I'm with somebody who takes their job as seriously as I do and has the passion for it that I have for my job. And sometimes there's that jealousy that he loves his work more than me. And I can connect to that song. And if I can connect to that song, being with a man who works for John Deere has nothing to do with the Celtic seas or the rough winds or anything, then I think a lot of people can relate to just that little bit of jealousy of, would he prefer to be working at the computer on his job than quality time with me? I just think it's such a basic human feeling. And it obviously happens all over the world.
She scorns the landlocked ladies as they wait upon their man, and they scan the red horizon till the fleet is seen again.
Jennifer moved to Brazil to be with her fiancé. She's a musician, and she told him that means she can work anywhere. So now she seeks the Celtic music scene in South America. It's small, but it's there. She found a few Celtic music festivals, some Scottish Highland games, even performed at a Robbie Burns dinner. But being in a rich musical environment like Brazil offers a unique opportunity, and while she doubts she'll soon be incorporating the traditions of Brazil into her music, it seems inevitable that something South American might somehow creep in.
It's not my main purpose while I'm there to really do a lot of performing, although it's hard not to perform. It's kind of, when it's all you've done your entire life, it's hard not to perform, and you just kind of desire those performance opportunities. So I am performing. However, I'm spending most of my time taking Portuguese classes and doing as much as I can to learn more about Brazilian music, because when else am I going to have this opportunity to do that other than when I'm living in Brazil?
It's the moon going home. It's the moon going home. It's the moon going home.
Jennifer Leko's latest CD is titled A Thousand Curses Upon Love. A couple updates since this first aired in the spring of 2008. Jennifer is no longer in Brazil, having relocated back to the mainland U.S., Minneapolis, Minnesota to be precise. But she is returning home to celebrate the holidays with a series of Celtic Christmas concerts. Appearances include tonight and tomorrow at the New Bern Civic Theater, next Thursday the 12th at Jocelyn Hall on the Carter Community College campus in Moorhead City, and next Sunday the 15th at Swansboro Middle School. I'm George Olson.
You can download a free holiday track by Jennifer Lico at our website. More information at the sound page under the programs tab at publicradioeast.org.